places.
We're especially delighted, given our focus on this topic, to have with us Dr. Ashish Jha, who is an expert in this area and who's been meeting with us and advising us this morning. Dr. Jha is an associate professor of health policy at Harvard School of Public Health, associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, and he's a staff physician at the VA Boston Healthcare System and at Brigham and Women's Hospital. And in the capacity in the VA, is currently serving as senior advisor to the Undersecretary for Health and Veterans in the VHA, focusing on areas of clinical quality and patient safety. Dr. Jha was trained at Harvard Medical School, went on to do internal medicine at University of California, San Francisco, and completed his general medicine fellowship here back in Boston at Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School, as well as his MPH in clinical effectiveness from the Harvard School of Public Health. And these days, he's working on quality and safety of medical care, racial disparities in health care, and the impact of information technology in all of these areas. He's worked in areas evaluating the quality of hospital care, especially hospitals that care for large minority populations such as ours, and the impact of health information technology and public reporting on quality of care. So we welcome him and look forward to his thoughts.
Thank you. All right. So one of my least favorite things is standing behind a lectern. So I'm going to try to speak like this, and the question is, can you guys hear me okay? Otherwise, I'm going to make you all come up here. All right. So Nancy and I had a series of emails back and forth about 3-4 weeks ago about my potential topic. And I say that as a way to say this is a new talk for me, meaning I haven't sort of sat down and thought about this issue of how will minority-serving hospitals fare under the ACA, the Affordable Care Act. And so I've put a set of thoughts together, but to the extent that this is a discussion and conversation, it'll be more interesting for me. I think it'll be more interesting for you guys. So stop me along the way and ask me questions. We're a small enough group. And is this projecting okay? I'm wondering if we need to... You guys can read that? All right. So what I'm going to do in my prepared remarks, and again, if I don't get through all my slides, I definitely do not care. But what I'm going to try to do is first start off talking about why focus on these providers that seem to care for a disproportionate number of minorities and underserved populations. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about delivery system reform under the ACA and think with you guys about the likely impact on these providers. I'm going to share some important caveats actually throughout the talk, and then kind of finish up with what I think policymakers can do if they care about both improving quality and improving equity in care. Okay? So that's the agenda. It's an ambitious agenda for the next 50 minutes or so. We have till 1? Great. All right. So I don't need to tell this crowd, but you know, disparities in health care are pervasive and persistent. And by the way, I said disparities in health care. There are disparities in health, but there are also real differences in how patients are treated when they get into the healthcare system. And these disparities in healthcare have a big effect on people's health. And so I think we all agree that improving care for underserved populations should really be a major policy priority. And my personal feeling, in editorializing, is that it has gotten inadequate attention under the Affordable Care Act. So if you think about concentration of care, and I'll explain what I mean by that, as a lens for disparities, it gives you a slightly different perspective. So as opposed to thinking about minority patients versus non-minority patients, which is an important kind of an overall concept, one thing to understand is that care for minority patients is very, very concentrated. What I mean by that is on the hospital side, and by the way, for the talk today, I'm going to mostly focus on the hospital side, a very small number of hospitals care for most of the minority patients in America. So 5% of hospitals in America care for nearly half of all black patients. And 25% of hospitals, so about 1 in 4 hospitals, care for nearly 90% of all black patients. So another way to think about it is 3/4 of hospitals in America almost never see an African-American patient, or very, very rarely do. Right? If care for Hispanics is even more concentrated, partly because Hispanics, Latinos, are very regionally distributed, meaning that there are large parts of the country where there are not significant Latino populations. And so if you understand that and think about that, it has really profound implications for thinking about disparities, right? Because, for instance, on a quality thing, you don't have to try to improve quality for all at all 5,000 U.S. hospitals to really impact minorities. If you want to improve care for minorities, you can target hospitals that disproportionately care for that population. And how these minority-serving institutions do will have a very profound impact on the healthcare for minority patients. And what I'm going to sort of try to argue for you guys is that how they're going to fare under the ACA is not really clear, but there are reasons to be concerned about how this is going to play out. Okay, so let's talk about the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, sometimes known as the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. The primary debate, the Supreme Court hearings that are going to that are coming, all the sort of discussion has primarily been about insurance expansion, right? The ACA broadens coverage through Medicaid. It sets up private insurance exchanges for others who are not covered. It does leave 18 million or so Americans out, and that'll, I think, have important implications for when we think about hospital financing. But whatever you may feel about the ACA, I think one thing that most people agree with is that it's a pretty big step forward in terms of covering all Americans. One of the things that people don't spend as much time talking about when they think about the ACA is that there's a bunch of things in there to fix the healthcare delivery system. So it's not just insurance expansion. It's actually an effort to change the way we deliver healthcare. So when I think about the big delivery system changes in the ACA, I think about five things, and it's sort of a lie. There are really four, because the fifth one is not in the ACA, but I'll explain that and try to slip it in. The first, and again, this is in terms of focus on hospitals. The first is value-based purchasing, and I'll go through that in a second. The second is readmission penalties. Third is bundled payments. Fourth is around accountable care organizations and patient-centered medical homes. And then the one that I'm trying to slip in is around health information technology. That's really actually from the stimulus bill. It's not part of ACA. But it is a big reform effort. And all of these things are trying to improve quality and safety and efficiency of hospital care, and actually care overall. Okay? Questions or thoughts about these? I will go into the details, but is this stuff all pretty familiar to people? Most people have heard about value-based purchasing. How many people have heard of VBP? As a very specific policy thing. Okay, hands up one more time. So actually a small minority. All right, I'll get more into details, but it's actually a big deal for hospitals that hospital payments are now going to be tied to how they do on a bunch of quality measures. Let's get started on some of these. Oh, and by the way, one other thing I want to mention before I move on is that the ACA does a few other things as well. So beyond these delivery system changes, which I'll go into in more detail, it makes some other changes in the way it pays hospitals. So one of the things it does is it reduces payments through the DSH program, the Disproportionate Share Hospital Program, which was set up really for hospitals that disproportionately care for poor patients. Those payments are not going to get completely phased out, but they're going to get dramatically scaled back. And then the other thing that's really important, both in the ACA but in every other budget proposal you will see, is there is every time anybody, President Obama, the Democrats, the Republicans, anytime they come out with a budget, they always make payment cuts to hospitals. And the reason they make payment cuts to hospitals is because they think this is a very painless way to cut Medicare spending, because hospitals are wasteful and inefficient, and we can cut payments to hospitals and they're going to do fine. I actually think that's wrong. But that is the widely held belief in Washington. Okay, so big delivery system changes and then also payment cuts on top of that. Questions, thoughts about any of that before I get into more details? Does that all make sense? So those are the sort of big things under ACA. All right, so the title of the talk is How Will Minority-Serving Hospitals Do Under ACA? And I always begin, anytime I do a talk about what will happen in the future, I think about the Yogi Berra quote, which is prediction is very hard, especially about the future. And it's meant to be a joke. Thank you for laughing. You guess what it means. But the really hard part about this is I'm going to try to show you a bunch of data for today and try to tell you that it means something about the future. And the truth is, it's always hard to predict the future. Things can be different in the future than we think they're going to be. But so it's worth keeping that caveat in mind as we move forward. All right. So when you think about these five different things, and I'm going to go into details on all of them, They are a mix of rewards and penalties. So right now, most people agree that the payment system we have for the way we pay for healthcare in America is pretty lousy, right? It's mostly fee-for-service. You show up, you get paid more. And so you get paid for doing more stuff. You don't necessarily get paid for doing better stuff, right? Everybody sort of has heard that notion. We all buy it. Most of the times when I say that, people nod. Yes, we all agree that we pay for quantity, not quality. So the people who wrote the ACA are trying to change that. They are now trying to pay for quality and not just pay for quantity. That is what they would argue, and certainly that's what is in the bill in terms of what they're trying to do. And some of those changes are rewards. You get paid more if you provide better quality. Some of them are penalties. You just get paid less if you provide bad care. The provisions also mix improvement and achievement. Let me explain what that means. So some of the provisions for how we're going to change payments to hospitals is based on standards. If you provide really high quality care, you'll get your bonus. If you don't, you won't. Some of them also give you credit for improving. And that becomes really important because if you're a hospital that's a low performer at baseline, improvement becomes an important way to get some of your money. So just understand that it's a mix of different stuff. All right, let's talk about value-based purchasing since most of you had not heard about VBP. What VBP is it's a holdback on Medicare hospital payments. So by the way, the average margin for a hospital in America right now is about 1% or less than 1%, okay? So hospitals run on a very tight margin. And if you make small payment changes, it can actually have a profound impact. A hospital can go from being essentially profitable or breaking even to losing money. What VBP does, it starts with a 1% holdback. So it takes your Medicare reimbursements. So let's say BMC last year got, I have no idea, $50 million from Medicare. It starts off by holding back 1% of that, and it says, we'll give you that money back based on how you do on two sets of things. Process measures around quality measures, and HCAHPS, which is a measure of patient experience. All right? And how you do on these two measures is going to determine whether you get all of that money back, some of that money back, or not. What's also clear is that that's where Medicare is starting. But it's going to add other things like mortality rates, measures around efficiency, as well as potentially patient safety indicators. Those are all going to go into the value-based purchasing model. And right now, it's starting with a 1% holdback. It's going to go up to 2%. And the idea is it might keep going up. Yes?
I want to ask a question about the choice of process measures. Do we know that some process measures are getting A1Cs in diabetic patients don't affect the outcomes?
Yes. No, so they're focusing on is so this is on the hospital side. You have the HQA measures, the Hospital Quality Alliance measures, and they're focusing on a subset of those measures. But there's no sense of clinical prioritization saying these are the ones that matter the most and they'll be in versus ones that don't. Okay, they've all been vetted and gone through the NQF National Quality Forum process. So they're all sort of signed off on as process measures. Okay? Questions or thoughts about how VBP works? So every hospital in America, by the way, is now going to be, not going to be, it is now, as of this year, being paid on this model. Okay?
Are there any concerns about gaming and so on? Because we haven't had this kind of thing before.
So the question is, concerns about gaming. Hospitals would game such a thing? There are always concerns about gaming. If you think about the two sets of measures right now, process measures and patient experience measures, they're both stuff that gets audited, so hospitals are not going to blatantly lie. You're pulling stuff from charts, so if you have your pneumonia measures, you have to pull all your pneumonia patients, look at how often they got their antibiotics on time, et cetera, and report all that to CMS. The hospitals have been publicly reporting this stuff for about 6-7 years now. So they're doing it, and it is audited. So there's not, I think, outright fraud, though you can imagine that hospitals could try to do other things to improve their performance on these scores. Yeah?
Are you going to talk about this later, but the potential problem of this focus on process measures
No. So the second one is easy. They are not risk-adjusted because the idea goes, if you're an acute MI patient, you should get an aspirin, whether you're really sick or not so sick. You know, it does have all the standard exclusionary stuff, like if you are allergic to aspirin, you can't get aspirin. But it's not risk-adjusted. And to what extent these process measures are linked to outcomes and whether we have any reason to think this stuff is going to drive improvements in outcomes is a terrific question. I think we have good reasons to believe from the empirical data that it's probably not going to have much of an impact on outcomes. But many of these process measures are clinically pretty reasonable. Antibiotic timing, there's pretty good data that getting antibiotics earlier is better than getting it late for pneumonia, et cetera. So they're not the worst measures. It's just they're pretty limited. Yes, sir. Yeah, so the question around teaching to the test is a really good one. What we've seen, because these measures have been publicly reported for about 7 years now, six, 7 years, most hospitals have gotten very, very good at these, and the differences between hospitals has gotten pretty small. And so now, the way that VBP is set up, you're going to reward one hospital that's at 97%, you're going to give them their full bonus, and another hospital that's at 94% might get much less because that 3% difference might be the difference between being a top performer versus being in the bottom half, because everybody's bunching up near the top. And so there's sort of a little bit of a craziness to it where you're driving hospitals to go from 94 to 95 without necessarily having a big impact on outcomes. Okay. Other questions or thoughts about this? Okay, so what I'm going to now show you is some data on process quality measures. And this is an interesting, okay, so let me show you just data. This is from a few years ago. This is by looking at hospitals and how they perform on these measures based on the proportion of black patients, and we had sort of different cut points of low, medium, and high. And you can see that for on the process measures, both for acute MI and pneumonia, hospitals, and the color scheme is not totally obvious. These are the hospitals with relatively few black patients. These are hospitals with more. And what you see is hospitals that disproportionately care for minority patients. We actually did this for Hispanics as well. The patterns are very similar. Hospitals with a higher proportion of minority patients tend to do worse on these process measures. This is, as I said, these data are a few years old. We had a paper published just about 6 months ago where we actually try to look at two different notions at the same time. And you'll sort of see that when you look at here. We try to look at hospitals. This, the motivation for this was a little different. We try to look at hospitals that were both high quality and low cost. These are the hospitals we sort of call the best hospitals, and it's really in quotes. And then we looked at hospitals, and so I'll show you that data. So about 7% of patients in these hospitals were African American. These are the high-quality, low-cost hospitals. So these are hospitals that should do pretty well under value-based purchasing because they're going to have good quality scores. And then when there are hospital payment cuts coming, what you're going to see is that these hospitals are already quite efficient, right? So low-cost hospitals. When you go to the high-quality, high-cost hospitals, it looks about the same in terms of proportion of black patients. When you go to the low-quality, low-cost hospitals, the proportion of black patients is higher, and it's much higher in the low-quality, high-cost hospital. So what does this set of data tell you? Two things that sort of consistent with the previous slide, but with much more recent data, that black patients are much more likely to be in quote-unquote low-quality hospitals. But it's not just about quality, it's also about cost, that these hospitals tend to be much higher cost. Okay? And that has real implications when we do payment cuts, because the hospitals that are high cost are going to have to figure out how to both manage quality, how both improve quality and lower their costs at the same time, or they're going to get into real trouble compared to the others. Does that make sense? Yes.
So I'm looking at the last column there. I don't know if this data taking into account that there are a lot of minorities living in urban areas and that general costs are higher in urban areas?
So our cost measures adjust for Medicare wage index. Absolutely. Otherwise, all the high-cost hospitals would be in Manhattan, New York, and not Manhattan, Kansas. Yeah, absolutely. So it takes that into account. It takes a bunch of other things into account that are outside of the hospital's control, but that payment changes would take into account. Okay? Questions or thoughts on this? Yes. Yeah, so we did not account for that on purpose because, again, our goal here is not to really figure out the underlying truth of management. Here is to say, these are the hospitals that should do very, very well under value-based purchasing, if you think of cost and quality as two measures, and these are the hospitals that are going to do much worse because they're going to have to figure out how to both improve their quality a lot and manage their costs a lot. And when I say manage their costs, they're going to have to figure out how to get much, much more efficient.
And costs are not based on reimbursement.
No.
They're based on
costs, as hospitals report their costs to Medicare.
Suspending.
Yes. Okay? All right, so that's, I want to move on to patient experience scores, HCAHPS. How many people have heard of HCAHPS? Okay, so good number. Almost every hospital in America does patient experience surveys when patients are discharged from the hospital, and they publicly report these performance, their performance on these measures. And what I'm going to show you now in the next slide is how the hospitals in the greater Boston area do on this. Okay, so your local hospital will be on here, as well as most other hospitals you know. So I just picked a small subset. And let me show you what these numbers mean. This is the percent of patients giving the hospital a 9 or a 10 on a scale of 1 to 10. So percentage of patients who say this is a really terrific hospital. And what you can see is number one in the greater Boston area is New England Baptist Hospital with 82%. Brigham and Women's, Mass General, Newton Wellesley, all in the mid-70s and higher. And here are the two worst performing hospitals on this measure. This is not meant to be a judgment thing. It's always dangerous to go give a talk at a center where then you show their numbers are not so good. But it's interesting, right, that the two lowest performing hospitals are the two safety net hospitals, arguably, in the greater Boston area. And by the way, these numbers, there's a huge drop-off here, right? These are mostly in the 70s, and so this is about 11 points lower. Cambridge Health Lions, 13 points lower. So really substantial differences in how patients are, and remember, this HCAHPS score is going to show up in value-based purchasing and the reimbursements that Boston Medical Center and the Brigham and everybody else gets from Medicare. So whether you like this measure or not, it's the reality of what's going to be in the payment stuff.
So New England Baptist is a special, is it primarily an orthopedic hospital? How do they account for specialty hospitals where they're going to be like, you know, very focused on a very specific type of care?
They don't. They don't. They don't account for that. They don't really account for much stuff. It's pure straight out your score. And HCAHPS is actually going to be a pretty substantial part of the value-based purchasing formula in 2012 as well as going forward. So that's the data for the greater Boston area. Now, this is data that we have under review. This is not about minority patients, but now we're looking at by DISH quartile, disproportionate share hospital index. So these are your safety nets out here. I know I'm not showing you any data yet. And we just took all the hospitals in the country, and this is a project I worked on with Paula Chatterjee, who's a medical student, and we just looked at how hospitals do on the HCAHPS scores. So the low DISH hospitals, the ones that have relatively few poor patients, their average score is about 70%. In quartiles 2 and 3, you can see it's 67 and 66. And then you can see that the safety net hospital. So this is nationally now, not just in the Boston area. You can see there's about a 6-point gap between the low DISH hospitals and the DISH hospitals with a high DISH index. Yes?
I have a question back on your previous slide.
Okay.
The one ranking the Boston hospital, sorry.
Yes. Yes. Not yet, but we have a grant that's pending that to look exactly at that question, because right now, so this measure does not adjust for race or ethnicity, and you could argue that that's potentially okay depending on how you think about this. But these are all hospital level data that are publicly reported, and our goal is to actually get patient level data, and then look to see how minority patients do in minority serving hospitals versus others, to try to tease apart exactly your question.
Why would you want to adjust the DISH percentage or the DISH quartile?
Would you want to? Are you asking?
Yeah, just compare similar hospitals, you know, that are, because they have, you know,
right, so,
to...
so we have, I mean, so our, my point on the next, oops, set of slides is, I mean, first of all, in the national formula, there's no adjustment for any of this, right? Because the argument is patient experience. You should be doing a good job with patient experience no matter who you are. And just because you care for more poor patients, this is the argument. I'm not pro or against. The argument is just because you take care of more poor patients isn't an explanation for why your patient experience scores are lousy. And there's some value in thinking about that argument. So you don't get an adjustment factor for having a higher DISH index or having higher proportion Medicaid. Yes, Adam?
You have quartiles here, but yep. This is probably a lot of, there's probably a lot of hospitals. Have you tried looking at deciles? Because I imagine that, I don't know if the...
Have if not the, looked at deciles. We could.
I don't know if that right most quartile is so uniform. My guess is that if you divided it into thirds...
Yeah. It's a great, we could look at that. It's a good question. This is definitely, this is about 3,200 hospitals. So even in a decile, we'd have 320 hospitals. Yeah, it's a great suggestion. Do it. But I don't have that. But it's a good suggestion. Other questions or thoughts about any of this? Yes.
Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah.
I'm wondering if at all, since you have a lot of hospitals here, look at the individual components. Because I believe that there are things like cleanliness of the bathrooms.
There are.
Different from TV in the room versus pain control. It seems like these are very different.
Yep. So we have looked at each of the 8 measures individually. I'm just showing you the overall one. And basically, safety net hospitals do worse on all 8. And it gets more interesting in the next slide. So. This is kind of getting cut off, but all right. So there are 8 different components. Thank you for setting up my next slide. And the way that value-based purchasing works is you get, there's a complex formula, but one of them is if you're at the national median or above, you get a certain bonus. So one of the questions we asked was, what percentage of hospitals have none of their 8 measures? Because it's at each individual level. And what we find is there's a pretty strong relationship between safety net status and having none of your 8 HCAHPS measures hit the national median. 1 in every 4 safety net hospital, every single of their 8 components of the HCAHPS is below the national median. And so they're going to get, and their odds of that is about 4 times higher than the low DISH hospitals. So it's going to have some pretty profound effects on who gets paid and how they get paid when it comes to HCAHPS. Okay? Questions or thoughts about this? So this is just my way of saying that these data translate into probably pretty substantial differences in payments around value-based purchasing.
So what's interesting is that in some ways it seems a little bit backwards when you're thinking about, I mean, it's one thing to ask the question and to do its research, but then to think about actual reimbursements, it seems like especially if possible they're doing worse, let's say, with cleanliness.
Yes.
You know, that they would need more resources rather than getting punished and then having fewer resources, you know, having resources withheld from them.
Yes.
So, yeah, so you asked for comments, and I was like, wow, that seems a little bit back. I mean, it's important to look at it, but then what's being done with it just seems like reverse of what should be.
Right. Depends a little bit on how you think about this stuff, and I am sympathetic to your perspective on this. And our effort around this has certainly been to take these data and share it with folks at CMS and basically give them a clear sense of what the impact of their policies are going to be. Oops, that's just my way of... All right, so summary, I've already sort of shown you this. Hospitals that disproportionately care for minority or poor patients, so they tend to be worse on HQA process measures, they tend to be higher cost, they tend to be worse on patient experience. Yes?
Are there any known strategies of how to improve performance on the HCAHPS, like coaching
So there are now, once HCAHPS got into the got out and became common, and then once it became obvious that it was going to be part of value-based purchasing, there are, I think, about 60 different consulting companies that are out there beating the doors of all the hospitals saying, we can improve your HCAHPS scores, including the Ritz-Carlton actually set up a hospital patient experience consulting company. So you can hire one. And they all have their own formula for how you do this. I'm a little skeptical of most of them, because nationally, we have not seen the numbers move that much. They've been moving up very, very slowly. But are there any evidence-based approaches? Not that I know of.
I just didn't know if they were, if the ones that are doing well are invested
Right, the challenge is it's a mix of stuff. So for instance, we see there's a really nice New York Times article about this. That people in the city of New York tend to have the lowest, or the hospitals in the city of New York have the lowest HCAHPS scores in the country. Now, is that because hospitals in New York are just lousy when it comes to customer relationships, or are New Yorkers just cranky? And the question of are New Yorkers just cranky was sort of essentially the title of this New York Times article. But it has, whereas in the South, patient experience scores are generally about 10 points higher than they are any other place in the country. Southern hospitality, different expectations. It's really interesting and hard to know. But it's a mix of stuff. All right. I'm going to move on to readmissions, my favorite topic, as I was saying earlier to Nancy and team. So one of the probably the biggest penalty in the ACA is for hospitals that perform worse than expected on readmissions, 30-day readmissions for acute MI, congestive heart failure, and pneumonia, Adams' three favorite conditions, as he was telling us earlier. And by the way, if you perform worse than expected, 1% to 2% of your total Medicare payments might be at risk. And the question is, do we have any guesses on who will do worse on these measures? And I'm going to show you some data. So, oops, this is fancier than I wanted it to be. All right. So this is from a paper that Karen Joint, who's a colleague of mine, and I published last year in JAMA, which basically looked at readmissions by race. And what you can see is that, on average, African-Americans have higher readmission rates than whites. You guys can see that okay, despite the lighting? Yeah, about 3% higher readmissions for acute MI, about similar for pneumonia, a little less for heart failure. The other thing we did was we looked at it by site of care, and again, sorry about, and here we looked at minority-serving hospitals, hospitals with a high proportion of black patients. We've also looked at this for Hispanics. The results are almost identical. And what we found was that hospitals with a high proportion of minority patients tended to have higher readmission rates across all three conditions. It begs the question that it's in the next slide. Whoa, sorry, the bottom got completely messed up. So let me walk you through this, unless anybody thinks they can read what's down here. Sorry, the formatting didn't look like this. White patients in non-minority serving hospitals, okay? White patients in non-minority serving hospitals. Black patients in non-minority serving hospitals. White patients at Newton Wellesley, black patients at Newton Wellesley. White patients at BMC, black patients at BMC. Okay, if BMC is a hospital that disproportionately cares for minorities, what you see is two things. There's a race effect. There's also an independent site effect. Minority-serving hospitals tend to have higher readmission rates for all their patients, more so for their black patients and their white patients, but it's independent of the race of the patient. Does that make sense? It would be a lot clearer if my legend in the bottom had not gotten messed up. Yes?
Is this adjusted for income?
No. No, it's...
So it implies it might be a hospital effect or it might be an income effect.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, that's my entire feeling about this, that it's... We have a perspective piece coming out soon that basically argues that readmissions are a pretty lousy measure of hospital quality because of everything else that's going on. Alok.
You decided to do this on a relevant effect measure scale rather than just doing the counts or something.
Well, we did do that too, but here I'm just presenting it to you as a relative. But we, you know, in the prior slide, you can see how this breaks down by actual numbers, right, for both race, and by site of care. And then here, I show it to you saying there's about a 35% higher odds of being readmitted if you're a black patient at a minority-serving hospital compared to if you're a white patient at a non-minority-serving hospital, just to give you some relative scale. And
I don't know how much of it is just an accident, but the magnitude of the difference between whites and blacks in both the settings are about the same.
Yes, that's interesting. Yeah, that's a good point. That the gap between whites and blacks is about the same at minority and non-minority serving hospitals, but the effect of site of care is about... is yeah. Okay, sorry. Now, I'm going to show you this last set of data. This is about our attempt to project who will get penalized And we don't actually know because CMS has not come out with this final rules. So we said, all right, let's just look at who ends up in the worst quartile of performance nationally. And one is obviously the reference group of non-minority serving hospitals. And what you see is across each of the three conditions, minority serving hospitals have about three times higher odds of being in the worst quartile nationally for readmission rates compared to non-minority serving hospitals. Okay? So small differences, about a 3-point difference in readmission rates, translates into a huge difference in terms of who ends up in the worst quartile because of purely distribution issues. If you think about how data are distributed, minority serving hospitals end up much worse. And then to your question around income, let me show you the next slide. Here, this is another paper that Karen and I wrote, published last year in Circulation Quality. We looked at hospitals and the income of the neighborhood that they were in. But we just split it by quartiles, and you can see that the lower the income of the neighborhood in which the hospital is located, the much higher the likelihood that they're going to be a bad performer. Does that make sense? It's a little depressing, sorry, but it's looking around, seeing a few depressed faces. But the point is that readmission penalties are not going to be uniformly distributed across all hospitals, and that hospitals that care for more minority patients and more poor patients are going to be far more likely to be penalized. All right, so I've already sort of made most of these points. And I guess the big point I want to make is when I think about what really drives readmissions, there's some empirical work and some work we're doing that seems to suggest that patient and community factors probably matter a lot more for readmissions than how good the discharge planning is at the hospital level. And it's interesting because the pushback from the folks at Medicare and others who've argued that readmissions is a good quality measure will say, all right, I get it. Hospitals only control so much of this. We want them to control more. We want them to go out into the community, build good relationships, make sure there are good services at home. And I'm sympathetic to that. But the point I like to make is that it's very different. What you're asking BMC to do is very different from what you're asking Newton Wellesley to do, right? And I can say that because I live a mile from Newton Wellesley Hospital. And, you know, when people are discharged on average from Newton Wellesley Hospital, the social structures and support and resources they have when they go home, I think make it far less likely that they're going to have to be readmitted to the hospital a week later. If they get sick, their ability to get in and see somebody quickly, all of that stuff is very, very different. And so the job at safety net hospitals is dramatically harder than it is at non-safety net hospitals. Yes?
Is there not a consideration for different policies for safety net hospitals?
Here is why the argument is no. Let me just kind of give you their argument. If you think readmissions is a good measure of hospital quality, okay, then you don't want to have a different standard for safety net hospitals, because then basically you're saying, and this is their argument, it's okay you provide lousy care, you just have a lot of poor patients. That's not what we want to argue. My take is it's not a good measure of hospital quality, and you've got to account for the fact that the patient populations are very different. So this is the philosophical debate. If you think it's a good measure of hospital quality, then you shouldn't necessarily be adjusting for your proportion of poor patients or minority patients. Nancy.
But moving it off of rehospitalization, because maybe that's not the best indicator, let's move it on to something that some indicator of quality that we can agree is a good one.
Yep.
The argument still holds about the safety net hospital performance versus, you know, the wealthy hospital performance. And this absence of risk adjustment for sociodemographic factors really concerns me, not only for hospital survival, but, you know, other things. And that coupled with the redirection of disproportionate share dollars in Massachusetts and now nationally suggests that these kinds of institutions won't survive.
It's going to be a huge challenge. So let's come back to that in 2 minutes. I'm going to show you just a little bit more data. Anybody else have questions? Yes. Yes. You know, I get it. The argument is we have a single standard for quality for everybody and not different standards based on it's an argument. And it sort of depends on what your kind of conceptual model is for how hospitals function, how much control they have over these quality measures. And the argument goes, these hospitals have not focused enough on quality. They don't get a pass because they take care of more poorer patients. Poor patients. All right. I'm actually going to not spend too much time on this because I want to show you one more set of data. But the two other reform things we talked about, bundle payments and ACOs, this slide is really easy. We've got no data on this yet. So I can't show you any data on whether ACOs are going to be harder for safety net providers versus others. But when I take a step back and think who is going to be successful in forming accountable care organizations, in being successful at managing costs and quality, it's hospitals that have patient populations with lower levels of fragmentation, adequate access to in-network specialists, can do well at hitting the quality targets, and have robust health information technology systems. Those are four key things that an ACO is going to have to do. We have very little data on how minority-serving hospitals are going to fare in this, but we do know a few things. In general, care for minority patients tend to be much more fragmented than it is for non-minority patients. So they're going to have a much harder time. Providers that disproportionately care for minorities are going to have a much harder time managing that. And as I've sort of already shown you, they have higher baseline costs and lower baseline quality. So even in the ACO world, and we're going to try to do some work around this, and maybe in a year or two I can actually show up again and give you some data on how minority-serving institutions have done under the ACO model. But right now we don't have any data. Okay. Really the last set of data I want to talk about is around health information technology. So in 2009, Congress passed and the president signed something called the High Tech Act. This was part of the stimulus bill. And basically, there were about $30 billion in incentives for doctors and hospitals to become meaningful users of electronic health records. Okay? So about $30 billion in incentives for hospitals and physicians to adopt electronic health records. And there were special provisions for high Medicaid providers. The incentives began in 2011. Penalties will kick in about 3-4 years for hospitals that don't meet meaningful use. And basically what it means to become a meaningful user of electronic health record is you have to adopt a certified electronic health record, and then you have to be able to do a bunch of stuff, like you have to do electronic prescribing and clinical decision support. There's a bunch of tools you got to be able to demonstrate that you do. And so we just got the 2011 data, and we're still analyzing it. I don't know what's going on with my scaling here, but you know how this is going to go. Low-dish hospitals, high-dish hospitals on the right, and what we did was we looked at what proportion of hospitals can meet meaningful use, are likely to get incentives, and what you see is that the high-dish hospitals, again, the safety net institutions, have about 36% lower odds of being able to meet meaningful use, so therefore likely to get the financial incentives that the government has set up. And if they don't get there by 2015, they're going to start getting penalized in terms of Medicare payments. All right. So this is my sort of summary slide. I would love to have a kind of conversation about this. But what we know from the stuff I've shown you is hospital care for Hispanic and Black patients is very concentrated. And how these institutions fare under the ACA, I think it's going to have a profound affect care for minority patients. And here's what we know. We know that these hospitals are starting off worse on the HQA process measures, worse on patient experience, worse on readmissions. They have greater fragmentation of care around them, and they're starting off worse on health IT. So when you think about each of the five major changes within the ACA, what we don't know. What we don't know is how these hospitals are going to respond, right? And you can imagine telling a story where they improve across the board, across all of these different measures, they improve. You can also tell a story that they're going to really struggle with the multiple competing demands. We're not asking hospitals to improve in one area. We're asking them to do a whole bunch of different things at the same time. And I do think it's going to be a test of leadership for safety net hospitals. Where I think is likely to turn out is we're going to see some improvements on the process measures. But a lot of this other stuff, putting in an electronic health record, improving patient experience. Somebody asked me, how do we improve patient experience? We don't really know. How do we decrease fragmentation? How do we reduce readmissions? This is not easy, straightforward stuff. The CEO of this hospital can't just say, hey, let's just reduce readmissions by 10%. They can say that, but there's going to be a tremendous amount of work that's going to have to go into it, and it may or may not be successful. And so even though predictions are hard, prediction is hard, I see this as really, and I've used this phrase a couple of times before, I see this almost sort of as a death by a thousand paper cuts. No single issue that I've brought up is going to, I think, sink safety net hospitals. It is the fact that you have effort after effort after effort, safety net hospitals will always seem to end up in the worst performing quartile at the bottom. It's how these things come together that I think is going to pose the real challenge, right? So 1% on penalties from not meeting meaningful use, 1% to 2% penalties for having high readmission rates, 1% to 2% for value-based purchasing. Start putting it all together, and it ends up being real, meaningful, substantial penalties for these hospitals. That's just all the stuff. There's also all the payment changes we've talked about. And I think that this next 3-4 years is probably the single most important management challenge for safety net hospitals, or for any hospitals in America, since prospective payments were introduced 30 years ago. Yes, Karen?
Good question. Are there any minority-serving hospitals that do well?
Yes.
I think I've heard of Intermountain Healthcare.
Intermountain Healthcare is great. It's not a minority-serving hospital. In Salt Lake City, very small number. Yes. Oh, I love it. So that is, in fact, the exactly. So when I think about the way forward and how I would, I've had lots of conversations with senior people at CMS and other places about how do we move forward. The first thing we need to do, I think, is it's essential to track outcomes for these providers. So we actually don't need me showing up with data 2 years later saying this was a problem. What we want is we want to track this stuff prospectively to figure out how our safety net hospitals doing within each of these different areas. And we need sort of collaboratives that bring these minority serving hospitals or safety net hospitals together and a systematic approach to research to learn what works among these providers. Here's the point, and I think this is where you were going, Karen, is right now we do case studies of high performing hospitals. And one of my favorite, I saw these case studies of high performing hospitals on readmission rates, right? And like the number one hospital in the country was in like Ogden, Utah, 99% white. And number two was in Bend, Oregon. And you look at that and you go to a hospital in Jackson, Mississippi and say, why can't you be more like those guys? And they say, yeah, this has no resonance for me, right? But when some of the work we've done, we've actually looked among minority-serving institutions, and you see large variations. And in that, to me, lies gold. That's where you got to go look. You got to bring these institutions together, because there's also, by the way, just to be perfectly fair, a little bit of denial and I think, defensiveness, where these institutions say, oh, those hospitals don't have our population. They don't know what we're facing. When you bring institutions that have similar patient populations, that denial goes away. And I think the lessons to be learned are going to be much more applicable. And you need a combination of collaborative efforts as well as research to really pull this apart together. And there's a new Office of Minority Health at Medicare where I've been talking to the person who's heading that to try to do something around this in a very concrete way. Otherwise, I think we're going to be in trouble. And then the last part is, I think, what we're doing right now with Medicare and the delivery system changes under ACA is, in my mind, a little bit of the kitchen sink. We'll try VBP, we'll try readmissions, we'll do health IT, we'll do a little bit of everything. And I don't really think that's a very good strategy. I think we should figure out what the most important items are. We should hold everyone accountable for those. And then we should have a strategy for helping those providers who are willing to get better. But this idea that we're going to do all these 18 things at once, in my mind at least, is not the best strategy. All right, that's it in terms of my slides. We have a couple of minutes left. I showed you a bunch of different work. I want to mention the three main collaborators I've had on this and a couple of the main funders who've supported this work, Commonwealth and Robert Wood Johnson. But we have a couple of minutes. Happy to take more questions.
Who are some poster child hospitals? Like, does Henry Ford do well? Does UPenn do well? Like, who really?
I would have to look at the data, but the data tell us. I mean, there are data on this, and there are hospitals that perform phenomenally well where a large proportion of their patients are poor or minority, and they perform very, very well across. I don't have any off the top of my head. Yes?
Globalized payment, the bundle payment, which is essentially the cap
Yep.
And as I understand it, currently there's no risk adjustment for the payments either, or it's a very crude.
There is a risk adjustment. It's whether it's
like with age, maybe. I'm not saying maybe gender, but.
Well, so it depends on how you. If you're talking about the ACO stuff, or you're talking about the bundled payment stuff.
Both.
So they're different. So they're different. ACOs and bundled payment are different programs. And there is going to be some amount of risk adjustment. And actually, ACOs have the advantage that they're going to look at historical costs as a way to set your baseline costs. If you've generally taken care of a very expensive, sicker population, you will start off at a higher baseline. Because otherwise, you'll just reward the people who take care of healthy patients.
Right.
And we're doing that enough in other programs, so ACOs will not do that.
Yeah, but I think that's sort of disease-based. And, I mean, again,
yes.
Yep. Those
yep.
Things that, you know.
Yeah, no, I agree. There's a complex set of issues that all feed on each other.
Yeah.
Yep.
I feel like what you outlined here is a system where the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. And the sort of logical conclusion of that is that that bottom quartile will go out of business, will cease to exist. But I don't think that, like, Mass General wants to live in a world where there's no BMC. So I'm just wondering whether anyone
down that road. So I think that a couple of thoughts. I mean, one is the people who wrote the ACA genuinely did not want to see the safety net hospitals go out of business. That wasn't their vision. I just think the way they've set it up, that's essentially where they're heading. But they didn't really look carefully at the data before they concocted their policies. So I think there's a little bit of a lack of awareness that this is where we're heading. The second part is the caveat that I said early, and I want to reiterate, is I don't know how this actually plays out. So what you might see, I'm a little worried that we're not going to see this, but what you might see is safety net hospitals respond in a very robust way and manage all of these different things and do just fine. It's the reason why I'm skeptical of that is because we're not asking them to improve on one measure. We're asking them to do 10 different things while reducing their costs, while managing their population better, while putting in new IT systems. It's going to be very hard to see how they pull it out.
With reduced resources.
With reduced resources.
Because we're giving them less money.
Absolutely. So, right. So I share your skepticism. I think we're going to see a bunch of hospitals go out of business. I think that if you ask the crafters of the ACA, are you okay with a bunch of hospitals going out of business? They would have said, yeah. We have quality measures, and if you can't meet it, you go out of business, that's okay. I think they had not realized that that's going to be very closely linked to the patient population that those patients, that those hospitals care for, that it's not a random subset of bad hospitals, that we have not done an adequate job disentangling bad quality from the patient population that is being served. And it's that combination of stuff that I think the policymakers have not gotten yet. I agree with you. I don't think Mass General or Newton Wellesley is interested in a world where there is no BMC. All right. Maybe one. Any last-minute questions? All right. Well, thank you for your thoughts, and thanks for listening.